are two things that we need in order to finish the basic structure of our gauge theories. First, we need to look at the effect of this group quotient on the structure equation. Secondly, the group quotient gives us still some very special manifolds. We want to be able to generalize these things to make them weaker in various places. To encompass a more general set of manifolds and fields. So we'll set about those two things. So first, what happens to the structure equations when we take a group quotient? The answer is nothing. they look just the same, but they are in fact different. What we're doing is regarding different points within the big group as equivalent, but that doesn't change the structure equation. So suppose we want to consider the group quotient. We have a group G of group H. The Lie algebra is unchanged. Let me say it looks the same. But we're going to disregard some differences. I'll make that explicit as we write some things out. First, what we want to do is identify some generators with H and some generators with G. So let's look at the Maurer-Cartan generators. Let's look at the Maurer-Cartan equation. So for G, we have a bunch of one forms, omega A, and they satisfy a relationship like this. And the same should be true for H, but H is a subgroup of G, so some of the omegas span H. So what we want to do is divide out the indices for these omegas. So let omega A be one of two types. Let it be an omega A or an omega, choose the Greek index, say beta, where H has Maurer-Cartan equations given by what? Well, let's take the Greek one. So d omega beta is minus a half c, and then we need like an alpha mu beta omega alpha wedge omega mu. Now, that's some subset of the structure constants here. All right, what do we have? We've got A runs from 1 to K, let's say. Alpha runs from 1 up to M, and M plus K is the dimension of the full group. So A runs from 1 to N equal to M plus K. Okay, then because H is a subgroup, there can't be any other terms here. Let's see. Is that right? The commutators of two generators of, let's see, something's not quite right. I'm trying to think exactly what it is that's funny here. Now, if we split these out in general into two sets, I'm worrying about the example we did last time.
Yeah.
Right. Where we did FL2C.
Yeah.
And the commutator of what? The commutator of two K's gives a J. And what that meant was that the structure equation for a J had
a K part and a J part.
It had a K part and a J part in there. So let's see. So what does it mean for these span of subgroups? Let's look at all possible. Or wait, no, let's look at the generators first. So, we have generators of H and we have generators of G. Right, so the H's forming a subgroup means that a generator H alpha with a generator H beta is going to be a structure constant alpha beta mu H mu. And, alright, the H's have to close into themselves, so there can't be anything else. The G's can be more general. If we have a G A with an H alpha, all right, that can be some thesis A alpha mu H mu, or we could have A alpha B and some generator G B different from the H's. So we divide our generators into pairs like this as well. Then we can have the commutator of a GA with a GB, and that can be a CABC, GC, or it could be a CAB mu, H mu. You can have either one. The only thing that signal we have, that we have a subgroup, is that the commutator of generators of some, the commutators of some subcollection of generators closes into that same subcollection. That's what gives us the subgroup. Alright, so now we know there's one potential set of structure constants, namely an alpha and a beta giving a G-type thing. Those have to be zero in order for us to have a subgroup. So now we can look at these equations and say, what can happen here? Well, we're asking about when we can have a beta up on a generator. And for either of these, that has a Greek letter up, that has a Greek letter up. So we can actually have all possible combinations on this one. So let's answer the question then. So the Maurer-Cartan equation have D omega alpha. We'll have every possible combination here. We'll have C mu nu alpha omega mu omega nu. We'll have C, then we could have a mu A, so something like this the other way around. And we can get H type thing. So we could get some alpha with those two generators, so an omega A here. And we can have that one the other direction. That actually just gives a factor of 2. I'll go ahead and write it. So we can have C A mu alpha omega A wedge omega mu. If I interchange these, I get a minus sign. If I interchange the indices on the structure constant, I get a minus sign. The two minus signs cancel, so that just gives a factor of 2 here. Then we can have two G's giving an H. So we can have a half C AB alpha omega A wedge omega G. So all three possibilities for that. On the other hand, D of the G type omegas, there is a restriction here. To get an A up on a structure constant, we can have this one or we can have this one. But we cannot have two H's. So that gives minus a half C D with alpha with A. And just like we had up here, there are going to be two of those, so we'll just cancel one of these. So we can have the mixed commutator. And we can also have this one. We can have two G's. So minus a half C DC A omega B wedge omega C. Ah. Okay. Now, why
which second part?
What's that?
If you add one to the other, you're left with only subtract one from the other.
Well, these are different. That's not going to give us anything. The thing that's happening here is that, you know, this is the Frobenius theorem. I think a couple of us were talking about the Frobenius theorem at the end of last time. If you have some collection of differential forms whose exterior derivatives are proportional to those same forms, then you can consistently set that collection to zero. So, let's look at the Frobenius theorem. Suppose let's see, we have omega I equals 1 up to k, and we've got omega some others, a equals 1 up to m. That sounds familiar, but the omega I are in involution. There are several ways of saying what involution means, but the one that will interest us is that the exterior derivative of the omega I is some linear combination of let me use something besides the lambda there. Some Bij wedge omega j. Notice this Bij is a one form. Okay, d omega is a two form, so and omega j is a one form. But the point here is that d can be an arbitrary one form, right? We can write bij is bijk omega k plus bijA omega a. Now, it's a totally general one form, but the fact that d omega is at least linear. In itself is enough to trigger the Frobenius theorem. Then then we get a submanifold by setting omega I equals zero. Alright, notice omega I equals zero is a solution to this. So we've solved a certain subset, we've solved K of the structure equations just by setting omega to zero. And the remaining structure equations now describe a submanifold. That's the condition we have here. Okay. D omega alpha is general, but D omega A, there's no alpha beta term. Right, there's no term like this. This is the only term that could keep omega A from being in involution. Right, it's exactly that term that that would muck up the Frobenius theorem applying to omega A. What that means is that if we set omega A to zero, all right, first of all, we can set omega A to zero. That would solve this equation. It wouldn't if that term was there. Right, that would survive. So we can set omega A to zero. If we do that, the remaining structure equation describes the submanifold, and now that goes away, and that goes away, and we're left with just this first part that is the structure equation for H. So we need this idea of involution in order to see where H lies inside the structure equation.
You wrote that differently yesterday when you wrote call it omega I equals constant of some ni equals zero. You've got another term here.
Where?
That you didn't. Well, it's right. This one's right yesterday, so I'm not pretty sure. But you've got another term here that I think wasn't there yesterday.
This equation is that one there with the B. I wrote B instead of A.
I'm not understanding why you're setting it equal to zero. How we get away with that?
Well, okay. The theorem states a little more than this. So let me see if I can give you a full statement of the Frobenius theorem. It has to do with actually solving an equation. It tells you something about the nature of solutions to that equation. Let's try and write it down. Let's try the Frobenius theorem again. So, given a system of differential equations that you use of the form, this is probably more general than it seems. I think you can write every set of differential equations as a set of first order equations just by introducing more variables. So if you've got something second order, you define a new variable to be the first derivative, and now you've got two first order equations. So we have d omega a is, let's suppose we have a d omega b and d omega I is, let's suppose that's general. So we've got some aij omega j plus c I a omega a. All right, where A, B, and C are general one forms. Right. By a general one form, I mean that it's an arbitrary linear combination of the full basis. So we have a basis consisting of omega A's and omega I's. So this is some AIJK omega K plus AIJ D omega B. And similarly for B and C. Okay, so that's just defining a system where this applies. Then let's call this 1 and 2. 1 expresses involution of d omega A. Okay, so here's the claim of the theorem. Right, that's the setup. Any questions on the setup? All right. So the key point is that the d of the omega a is linear in the omega a. Then here's the conclusion. Then. let me specify a couple more things. A equals 1 through, let's say, K. I equals 1 through M. K plus M is N. The omega A, omega I form a basis on an n-dimensional manifold. Okay, then there exist coordinates XA, A equals 1 to K, such that the omega A's are some linear combination of the X's. Let's take some constant, some matrix, CAB, DXB.
Right, so you can find K coordinates such that the omega A's can be expressed just in terms of the differentials of those K coordinates.
Holding XB constant and omega A 0 restrict to a submanifold
Let me stress the difference between a subspace and a submanifold. Okay. For example, let's think of something that's a subspace but not a submanifold. They're trivial examples, but
let's take the plane R2 and take the collection of lines. There's a line, and here's another line, and there's a third line. Those three lines form a subspace, some one-dimensional subspace, but they do not form a manifold because you've got some bad points here there's not a chart into R1 at these crossing points. There's no chart from some open set here into R1 that is one-to-one onto like a chart needs to be. So you've got some points that are not manifolds. So you can easily have subspaces of a space that are not manifolds. A manifold has a smoothness property. It looks like Rn everywhere. And this involution condition is an integrability condition that will guarantee that that is satisfied for the x equal constant subspaces. They will actually be manifolds.
Before you get too far ahead, is the statement that omega A, omega I form a basis, is that supposed to be obvious?
A basis to the cotangent space at each point of the manifold. So at any point of the manifold, we have a vector space of differential form of n dimensions. It's like if there's a tangent space, that's the directional derivative to the point, then there's the space of differential forms, and that's spanned by the coordinate differentials at that point, or by any non-degenerate linear combination of those. So we could have, we know we have n coordinates, but by the fact that all of this take place on an n-dimensional manifold, we know we could find n coordinates, let's say YA, A equals 1 to n, that span that manifold, or in some region of that manifold. So for these to form a basis, we need to be able to write write them as linear combinations of the dy's. So you can think of running out of space here. This is an invertible relationship. If I can write the dy's in terms of these, you know, if this is invertible, then these will form a basis. So any n independent one forms at each point would form a basis.
So it's not the manifold itself, it's actually the cotangent space.
What's that?
It's not the manifold itself, it's actually the space.
Yeah, it's the cotangent space.
That's right. Right.
Okay. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm slightly in a different place, but could this somewhat be analog to the idea of a null space in set to zero when you're solving
Linear
equations?
Yeah,
null space officially could be anything, but we set it to zero so that we can solve the equation.
Yeah. That's probably an analogous idea. That's what we're going to do here, because on the submanifold, we have the remaining equations, right? We have these equations with omega A equals zero.
Right.
So we just have d omega I is now Aij wedge omega j. That's a simpler set of equations than these. And so we can solve those, or hopefully we can solve these. And that gives us information about how to solve those.
Right.
Then we come back.
The null space.
Yeah. This doesn't mean that we're always going to hold x constant.
Right.
But if we can find a solution for this omega, and then I can show you what you do. Okay. So this is the theorem. Okay. These are the conclusions we have. The conclusion that we can solve an involute equation for K one form in terms of K coordinates on some higher dimensional manifold. And holding those coordinates constant gives us a submanifold and a description of the system of equations restricted to that submanifold. So here's a little bit of technique. We solve the reduced system by, a solution to this is going to be in terms of some, how many coordinates? M coordinates. This is an M dimensional manifold. So, all right, we had K here. The whole space was N, so M is N minus K. So we've reduced it to a smaller system. So over here, we're going to have N minus K coordinates V. Let's call them, what do we call them? Vi. So we're going to be able to find omega I is some set of functions, what's a good letter for a constant here? These are some functions of the Z. So the solution to these equations will look like that on the submanifold. Right? The submanifold is spanned by n minus k coordinates. It's a manifold, we always have coordinates. So a solution for a one form on a manifold with n minus k coordinates Zi, it's going to look like that. It's going to be some linear combination with Dz. Now extend back. So XA is not constant. And what do we have? We have the omega A's now, but we know what they are. They're CABBXB. We know by the Frobenius theorem they can be written that way. The omega I's, we've partly solved them. The DZ part of these has to look like this. But now, since X is not constant, they may have lost something, IA DXA. There could be something like that as well. So the general solution to our original equation has to take that restricted form, where we already know these guys, and we've, instead of having, you know, four sets of coefficients, we're down to two. And now you substitute these back into the full equation and transform. So you've made progress towards solving. If you have an involution, it's a tool that you can use, and we frequently do. Yeah, Jeff.
It seems almost exactly like what you used to solve solutions to a null space equation. You just add the null space to your solution and you get a space that is the solution
okay.
of the equation.
Yeah, it's probably the same thing.
Well, and I was thinking the null space would be your projection space, and then the solution
What is your null space?
A null space is, say you have a system of equations,
yeah,
and it doesn't fully determine a theorem, or it doesn't fully determine your space. Null space is anywhere you can't get with a linear combination of those.
Okay.
So then, that would be a fiber bundle if you looked at it from a different point of view, where your fibers were corresponding to linear combinations of those things.
Not obvious. Yeah, there's a proof to be there, but the thing is that our equations 1 and 2 over here, they do determine the whole. They do determine all the omegas.
All right.
It's not quite clear to me where the null space maps. There could be a correspondence. You know, it sounds similar. I'm not sure. We'd have to look at it in detail. Okay, questions? It is the Frobenius theorem, then, back here that lets us see where the submanifold is. All right, the submanifold, we know that H is a submanifold because it's a Lie subgroup.
Well, I'm going to ask you to repeat yourself one more time on what the second term means. Why did we add that?
Okay.
Other than that we knew that it might exist from...
that's the reason. It might exist. All right, so you have to allow it to be there. This solution was found assuming X is constant. But this one form, this omega I is a one form on the whole manifold. So in general, it's going to look like that. You know, a general one form looks like that. So then you have to solve the equations to find out what exact combination. But meanwhile, you've found this M. By solving a reduced set of equations, you've been able to find M.
Does that help?
Good. So back to the Maurer-Cartan equations, where we're going to take a quotient. Okay, the quotient means we've got a subgroup. The subgroup means that the Maurer-Cartan equations will look like this, and in particular, it means that the one forms dual to the generators that don't generate H can be set to zero. They will be an involution. So having a subgroup of your Lie algebra guarantees that some forms will be an involution. In particular, in this case, the omega A's, the Latin ones. And if we look on the submanifold, these omega A's, B's, there are some coordinates we can hold that we can express those as differentials of. We can hold those coordinates constant. And when we do that, these two terms drop out as well, and we have a pure omega alpha equation that determines the one-form that span the directions of our subgroup, H. So this restricted equation, that's what we get down to when we use this involution to reduce the problem. We get down to the structure equations for H.
Anyone else want to hear that repeated?
Sure.
Okay, can I ask the leading question?
Yeah.
How can we tell that it's an involution in the first place so we can use
okay.
the technique?
If D of some subset of the omegas is at least linear in those same omegas.
Can you point to where we
so,
know that?
Okay, so each of these terms has to have at least one Latin omega. There's one here. There are actually two here. Right? I could write this. Let me write it in a way that makes it explicit. Let's see if I... Let me interchange these two pairs. So we have, sorry, what?
Latinese that extends the subgroup, is that correct? Is that what we're saying? Latinese that extends the subgroup, the submanifold.
The Latin ones are the ones dual to the G's, not the H's. Right? It's the Greek ones that are dual to the generators of the subgroup. So it's the alphas, it's the omega alphas that really span the subgroup.
Okay.
Let me flip these so we have a half C, D, C, A, omega C, which omega C. So I'll make this explicit. Here's some general one form. That's like this guy. That's like D here. Right, so d omega Latin is some one form times an omega Latin. We've got that here because I can pull out an omega Latin times some general one form. So this equation is involute. The involution means it's integrable in and of itself. Right, and we integrate it, that means we can find some x's that we, you know, we can solve it in that form. then we can hold those x coordinates constant, which means the Latin omegas go to zero. Right? When x is held constant, the Latin omegas are zero, and that simplifies the first equation. It simplifies it to an equation that, in fact, exactly describes the subgroup.
Other questions? Did that clarify it, John?
I think so.
Okay, so...
Quick question. So
yeah.
The top group is meant to be for the subgroup and the bottom one is for the entire group. Is that correct?
Yeah, this part describes the subgroup.
Okay. Right, it's all green.
Right, yeah, there are other parts here, but they go away when you use the involution. Okay.
But in a subgroup, or...
Yeah.
Why would you get other things in there? I mean, if generators go to themselves, you know, within the commutator, right?
Think of the Lorentz group. We had exactly the situation. Okay, the generators for this, the Lie algebra. Have you got this?
Or let me get this.
Okay, the Lie algebra for the Lorentz group. The J's generate a subgroup.
Right.
Okay. I'll write out the example for you. Did we write that last time? I'm not sure how many people were still here when we wrote it last time. I'll write it quickly again.
I'm not sure.
All right, here it is. so see, the Lorentz group, we have the commutator of the J's is one IJK, JK. Let's see, was there a two? I guess it depends on the normalization and our spine. Let's just pretend we've normalized it so that this works. A JI with a K, let me write it as an alpha, but I equals 1, 2, 3, and alpha equals 1, 2, 3. There are three of each, giving the six generators to the Lorentz group. A J with a K gives us the K back. I alpha beta K beta. And if we take two K's, K alpha, K beta, there are some signs here. I forget what the signs are. Alpha, beta, K, JK. This is...
Are there also coefficients of two?
Yeah, I think we had two. Do you have the signs there? What are the signs?
With K, negative. With J, negative. And I and J, positive. Just two K's?
K
and KJ is positive.
A K with a K is a minus J?
A K and a K is positive.
Positive.
And the other two are negative.
Okay,
yeah.
Negative name. Okay, like that. And we could... You can redefine them to be minus what they are, and it changes that, but... okay, so these are the structure equations we had. Then the Maurer-Carton, how are they going to look? We're going to have dual to the J's. We have some omega J's. Dual to the K's, we have some let's call them eta. We get Kronecker. Beta alpha. And then D omega J, okay, notice what happened. Two Lorentz boosts commute by a differ by. So if I boost this way and boost that way, or that way then this way, the two results differ by a rotation. Right? So there's a J here that wasn't there in that subgroup. Right? That looks like a subgroup. Right? That closes. No problem. But if we look at the Maurer-Carton equation, we're going to have, okay, anything that gives a J, well, that's going to be this one or that one. This one, we have minus 2 epsilon ik j omega I wedge omega k. That's fine. But we also get this one. We have minus 1/2. Then we have 2 epsilon alpha beta j omega, or eta alpha with eta beta. Alright, so that does not scream subgroup at you. But now, if you look at the d8s, what we'll find is, alright, we only get one term. We'll have minus 2 epsilon I alpha beta, and we get it both ways, so there will be another factor of 2. But we have an omega I wedge eta alpha, and our factor of 2 because we get them both ways. But notice that this equation is involute. Right? The eta's, alright, d of eta is proportional to eta again. This equation is not involute. D of omega, this one doesn't have an omega in it. So I could not consistently set omega to 0 here, but eta equals 0 is a solution to this one. So if I just hold the boost constant, right, so eta alpha can be written as some matrix A alpha beta times some coordinate dx beta. On the group now, well, these are boost parameters, right? Those three x's are velocities in three directions or something. Some three parameters to describe the boost. We hold the velocities constant. Why don't I call them V when, you know, that's what they are, really. We hold all the velocities constant. Nobody's doing any boost. What's left of the Lorentz group? The rotation. If I hold A to zero, this term goes away. And we're left with the structure equation for the rotation group. And we can set about solving it. Okay. So, an example. Let's see. That's where the subgroups come in. Now we have to address what it means to take a quotient. So, once again, we've got some Maurer-Hartong equations. We've got a group and a subgroup. So, the equations look like this. Let's start fresh and tidy up. So, you get...
Hold on one second.
Oh, okay.
Did you say that the second equation is the one that's in blue and eta is what gets set to zero?
That's right. Yeah.
So is this the formal way of proving that subgroup is a subgroup?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you could get there from this. Now, it's not the only way. Another way is to look at the commutators. Mm-hmm. If the commutators close, if some subset of the generators have commutators that close into that subset, so the J's give a J back, that's a subgroup. It might actually be easier to spot from the commutators.
Okay.
But you can spot it here, too. You just need to know what to look for.
Correct.
Okay, you good?
Yes.
Okay. So let's suppose we have some equations like this. And we want to solve the system of equations. We know there's some subgroup, and we're going to count the directions in H as equivalence classes, right? Moving in the H direction, you know, doesn't change the physics. That's just a gauge transformation. So we want to We want to ignore differences in the H direction. How do we do that? Okay, so suppose we have the system. Suppose we want to solve and what do they look like? They look like this over here. D omega A for omega A omega let me call them eta's just so it's easy to spot which is which. You get too many omegas doing this. So we have D omega A is the involute one. It's going to be from C, B, B alpha A, omega alpha, and C, B C A, omega C, wedge omega D. That's the involute one, and then we have, except I said I was going to call these eta's, so let me do it. So then the eta is going to be the more complicated thing. We have a half C mu nu alpha eta nu wedge eta nu. And we have Let's see, we got two of that last one. So minus C mu A alpha eta mu wedge omega A, and finally a half minus a half C A B alpha omega A wedge omega B. So suppose we want to solve this system on the quotient because that's the problem that we have engaged here. Now, in general, let's see. Right, let's choose the coordinates. Let's see. How can we say this? Let's choose coordinates YA, and let's see, the omegas we said could be expressed in terms of some x's, and then there will be, let's call it ZA, and totally x's and y's. So we can find n coordinates where the x's, where the omega a's can be expanded in terms of the x's, where by Frobenius, we know that we can write omega a as some linear combination of the dx's. On the quotient, then in general, we know that omega A can be written that way, and the other omega, eta alpha, can be written as some d alpha beta d y alpha plus c alpha d dx b. Now, if we hold the x as constant,
just d y beta.
Beta, yeah. If we hold the x as constant, then the omegas are zero, and we're solving on the group manifold, right? That's the eta's span H. But so x a equals constant. We get the Maurer-Cartan equations for H, namely just d eta alpha is minus a half d mu nu alpha eta mu wedge eta nu.
We're saying that X expands H, the double
No, the X's span the base manifold. All right, that's what we're holding constant. So we're going to a fixed point of the base manifold, and now varying the coordinates only moves this up and down the fiber.
Okay.
So using the involution, we reduce to just this description of H of the subgroup. So what we're doing is solving for the fiber.
Okay. X A is for the base manifold, Y is for the coordinates along the fibers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, okay, but what this means is that, here we solve for eta alpha, we're going to get beta alpha d, the function of y is on the fibers. Well, on the quotient, we don't actually care about changing y. Y is moving us up and down the fiber. When we extend back, we don't care about the fiber direction or the H direction. Just what happens with changes in X. So what we really want to solve, right, since we can gauge the y dependence to anything we want, gauge it to zero. So we only want to solve the dx stuff. We want to regard all of the relevant forms as linear combinations only of the dx's. We solve that, and we solve the problem on the fiber bundle. That tells us how omega and eta vary on the manifold in a way that's independent of what happens as we move up and down the group. In fact, this term, we know how to solve that. That's just the solution on a group, and we're not going to generalize that part. We're going to curve this manifold. We're going to do some stuff to this manifold. But we're always going to keep that H symmetry, and we always know how to solve for the H direction. So anytime we want this, we can write it down. Just we can solve for the form of a basis on the Lie group. What we're really interested in, the tricky bit, is to solve for the X dependence. And so we regard these guys as equations just on the manifold. And that makes it a different problem. So even though the equations we're solving look the same as the equations for the Lie algebra, we're requiring the basis forms to be expandable just in terms of differentials of coordinates on the manifold. And so now we're solving a slightly different problem than we would have been solving if we'd just been solving for a basis for G, the original group. This will become particularly important when we add curvature, which is the next thing I want to do. So let me give you time for questions, and then we'll move to modifying the equations to add the interesting physical fields. Go ahead. Poll me with questions. You good?
Joe,
you've always got a good question.
I'm not sure if this is a good question.
They're all good questions.
What are we solving for in that system?
A and C.
A and C.
You want to find these coefficients.
Okay. And then, where does this go? Once we solve that, how...
Yeah, and, you know, we really want their X dependence here. We don't care how they depend on moving up and down the fiber. So, we're going to drop any dependence on that. We can put it back in. We can do transformations up and down the fiber if it makes our solution easier to do. And we'll see some examples of that. But what we're really interested in is how things vary across that quotient manifold.
In this example, what are we taking? Are we taking our quotient by?
H. This is G mod H.
Right, but what is H? What is the R?
H is the subgroup spanned by the H.
Okay.
So that there, these are the structure equations for H right here.
Eight is for the
J. The eight is for the J. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, the eight is for the subgroup.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dual for the J. Okay. Another question? So let's wiggle it. Shall we wiggle it?
So each fiber has its own coordinate system,
basically. There's a coordinate system that just moves you up and down the fiber. Yeah, in fact, it's pure gauge. You know, just doing a gauge transformation moves you up and down the fiber. And you can always do those transformations anytime you like. So if you find a solution of this form, we can now change the gauge, and all that'll do is put in that B term back. Right? But those coordinates are just dependent on our gauge choice, on which element of H we've chosen at each point of the manifold as a way of writing our fields, but it's a convenience. It's a symmetry of nature. It doesn't affect the physical stuff. So now, let's suppose we have a set of Maurer-Cartan equations. Let me think a second here. I want to generalize them. This step is important to understand. The fact that we can solve this system, it tells us what's going on in the manifold. We can always come back and do a transformation, a local H transformation, and add in arbitrary values of that term consistent with H. Right, that's a solution for H right there. So choosing Y is just choosing a particular group element of H. What we want to do is now to change the base manifold. And we want to do two things. Okay, so start with Maurer-Cartan. We have d omega. Let's look at this, just write the full system here. And now, modify by adding, all right, so we're going to change these things. And we want to change them in such a way that it changes the behavior of these forms as we move around the manifold. Modify by adding an arbitrary two form. FA to each equation. And require two things. One, integrability, and horizontality. Okay, now let me state briefly what each of those means, and then we'll start looking at some detail. Integrability, okay, this is a differential equation. We knew it was integrable before. Without that, d squared of omega A was zero by virtue of the Jacobi identity. So if I add some arbitrary two-form here, right, well, that changes omega in some arbitrary way. How do I know this is still integrable? In general, it's not. So what I have to do is require d squared omega A must still be zero. And we still have the Jacobi identity on these C's, but it's going to give us a condition on the A, on the F.
Equals zero.
What's that?
Is it going to be the df equals zero?
Not quite. It'll be a covariant derivative of f equals zero. But we'll see it. We'll do it. Horizontality. Okay. We don't want f to change when we change gauge. All right. We require f to, all right, it's a two-form, so I can write it as FA, in general, if I write a two-form on the bundle, so on the whole bundle, a two-form is a combination of several terms. We're going to have mu nu, eta mu wedge, eta nu. We're going to have some cross terms. Let's call them a mu a, eta mu, omega a, and f a b, omega a wedge, omega b. Okay, but the thing that we want to be the case is that if we do a gauge transformation, we're adding this stuff, we're changing this stuff, the B term of eta. We don't want that to change F. So F had better not depend on eta. Horizontality means that we can express this two-form we've added purely in terms of the one-forms that span the manifold. Right. Moving up and down the fiber does not change F. It's not going to do anything to those one forms. So this will guarantee that F describes properties of the manifold and not of the bundle. Right? You know, we certainly could define some F that depended on the whole bundle, but then we're working with the whole group. But we're interested in fields that just define properties of the manifold. So these two conditions. Horizontality, okay, speaks for itself. We assume that form for F. It always can be expanded in terms of just, well, effectively, the d-axis, coordinates in the manifold. Let's look at the integrability. That's not too hard to work out. All right. Zero must be d squared of omega a. And if I take d here, what am I going to get? We have minus 1/2 c dc a. And then we'll get two terms, d omega b wedge omega c minus omega b wedge d omega c plus d of our curvature F. You can call it a curvature, you can call it field strength, whatever. Now, if I substitute for d omega, use the structure equation again to eliminate the d omegas, notice this is now the structure equation. Let's call this the Cartan structure equation. And we have to substitute that for d omega. The stuff that depends on the C's is going to drop out. That's just the Jacobi identity again. So we're going to have a half. Notice these two are the same. If I interchange those, I don't get a sign. But then if I interchange B, that becomes a plus, and I just get two of the same thing. So I'm going to have CB, CA. And then, let's call it plus and use the second one. We have an omega B, but then here, minus 1/2, I want to write D omega C. So I'm going to have a C, D, E, C, omega D, wedge omega C. And 1/2 CB, CA, omega B, wedge, okay, F. And then we have the DF. And this one, that's just the Jacobi. Right? We always get Jacobi back. So what we end up with is the exterior derivative of F plus 1/2 CB CA omega B wedge FC. And we define that to be the covariant exterior derivative of F.
Where do we get these two terms from? Did these both come from DF?
These two?
Which two?
Oh, never mind. I've substituted all of this for the omega. These two terms are the same.
Right.
So I lost the half. Wait, did I? Yeah. I should have lost the half. So those two terms give me... Wait a minute. Let's get our half right. What? That should be there, right? No. Hang on. Now I've confused myself. Let's see. This cancels the half, so there's no half. If I use this one, which I did, then it gets rid of the sign as well. So I have a C with that stuff, and I have a C with the F. Okay, this is right. No half. There we go. All right, so this is the... this actually is a covariant derivative. Okay, we've spent a lot of time talking about covariance, but this capital D is, by our construction, we have ensured that capital D is a tensorial derivative. That is, if we do a gauge transformation, an H transformation, capital D of F will transform linearly and homogeneously. It'll transform as a tensor. And we can check properties like that. We can run through that. Okay, so integrability, horizontality, now we've got a curved bundle. Now we have a field that describes stuff going on a manifold and it respects the subgroup symmetry. Okay, we've built all of that. We can now write down any gauge theory we want. All right, they all look like this. Suppose we rewrite this thing as an equation for F. What is that? V of omega. Where'd it go? Plus 1/2 BCA omega B with omega C. You ever see anything like that before?
Yes.
Riemann curvature two form. This is curvature we've got here. Okay, it just comes out by generalizing some group equations. Look at the Cartan structure equation. Just solve for F.
Oh, I see. Okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I haven't done anything. I've just rearranged. Let's see. There are probably lots of things we should check. Right? We should try a gauge transformation or something. We should show that these things have the properties that we've built in. The question is, how do we do a gauge transformation? The gauge transformations are H-type things. Yeah, in fact, the thing we've constructed, it may be best to go back to the our basic definition of a form as something you integrate. Right? If we integrate these quantities, like what could we integrate? Integrate any one form in sight around any curve between two points of the whole bundle. Okay, the result of that integration is independent of H. These are our gauge fields or our connections. And if we integrate how would we see that? I'm not sure how to say that without getting confusing. Probably enough to think about right now. So I'm trying to think of what will clarify rather than further muddy. Any thoughts, Juan? Let's see. I'd like to show... It'd be nice to show covariance of this derivative, for example. It'd be nice to show that... F transforms is a tensor. But what we really need to do that I'm not sure we quite have the tools yet. Let's see. We know that the group acts on the Lie algebra. We know that the group acts on some vector space. Now, that might be a way to go. Let me just talk aloud here, see if I come up with something sensible. If we try to write down a representation of the group, you know, we're going to, basically we're going to write some matrices that whose multiplication properties mimic the multiplication of the group. It's a linear representation of the group, and it's defined once you tell me what dimension to make the matrices. So equivalently, tell me what vector space I want the group to act on. That, in particular, determines the dimension of the vector space, and now I know what dimension matrices to try and find to represent the group. So, suppose we find some such thing. It's a linear representation of a group. And usually, I think in all the cases we're going to be dealing with, I don't think we'll do any of the exceptional groups. We'll be able to write our group transformations in some linear representation. So we need the vector space that the group acts on. Now, on that vector space, let's see, there are certain ones we can always define. There's always an n-dimensional representation of an n-dimensional group. And you can actually build it out of a structure constant. That's probably not the one I want to use, though. I mean, it's a nice one, and it's useful for some proofs. But, let's see, if we have a group acting on a vector space, then we can define a group covariant derivative on that vector space. And let's see, what'll it be? Act on B to give some B prime. All right, suppose we want a derivative such that, which is covariant, so that B prime of B prime is, so if this is B prime, what we want is for this to be G of DV. Okay, that's what it would mean to have a covariant derivative. Now, we can define such a thing as, let's see, we need, a connection. And the connection needs to be a Lie algebra valued one form. That'll go. Okay, so we'll use and we'll come back to this, I think. But I'll finish out my thought on this.
When I went through and put the analog between that and doing the null space problem,
did that work out?
Exactly analogous.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, you'll have to show me what you're thinking about. We'll take a look later.
Yeah.
The thing we need to do this is a covariant derivative, and that's going to be an exterior derivative plus a connection that can do one of two things. Okay, this has got to be a one form, and it has to
perform an infinitesimal, CJ, infinitesimal group transformation. Of V. So it's got to be a one-form to keep a one-form equation, but it's some linear transformation of V. This is what a connection does. Well, the things that act on V are elements of the group, and the things that act infinitesimally on V are elements of the Lie algebra. So the combination here is a Lie algebra valued one form. So the thing we need to build a covariant derivative is a Lie algebra valued one form. Guess what these are? A index, Lie algebra valued. It's a one form. So these guys are going to be our omega A's. We want a Lie algebra valued. Okay, fine. Suck them onto a generator, right? This generator now is some, if V is, suppose this has dimension D, then I and J equal 1 through D. It's a D-dimensional linear representation of the group. So these can be any kinds of matrices, but now, omega is a Lie algebra valued one form when we do this, and that means it's a connection. It's a connection for a covariant derivative. Then, given that, we can find how it needs to transform in order to work as a covariant derivative. Alright, what we need is d prime of d prime has to be g d of v. D prime is d plus a prime acting on g v. Then we have g acting on dv plus AB. There's a whole lot written in this notation. There are indices all over the place, and I haven't written any of them. Right? This A, it's an ugly bugger like that. You know, it's a linear combination of, it's a one-form valued linear combination of generator matrices. Right? There are three different indices in this. If I wrote out everything in sight, we've got some base manifold. How big is our base manifold here? Let's use, say, Greek for that. So it's a one form. It's an element of the Lie algebra. As an element of the Lie algebra, it can be expanded in generators of some dimension representation. So there are three different indices going on in this equation that I've written no indices for. Now we multiply this out. What do we get? We get dg on d plus a prime g d. There's the other term here. We get g dv plus dg d. That has to be g dv plus g a b. The dv's drop out, as they always do, and we see that A prime G acting on V has to be equal to G acting on A, or a GA minus DG acting on V. Since this is true for all vectors in our vector space, we can write it as an identity on the connection. And now multiply on the right by G inverse
and we see that we get something that would be tensorial. Remember this A, this whole thing is A. It's a matrix, so sandwiched between, we do a similarity transformation, but there's an inhomogeneous term, minus DG, G inverse. That is always how a connection transforms. We saw something like that for the Christoffel connection under a coordinate transformation last semester. It was a big, hairy, ugly thing. There's this inhomogeneous term. It actually looks just like that, where G is a general coordinate transformation.
Yeah, we had Jacobian, inverse Jacobian, and then we had the...
Yeah,
right.
That's right.
Why don't things cancel?
Matrix.
Right, but G inverse.
DG. The derivative of G is not proportional to G. Right, it's some other thing. It can be changing, arbitrarily. So, you can prove that combination is an element of the Lie algebra. This can be expanded in terms of the generators. So it does close back into the Lie algebra.
If it's G, the inverse.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Great. Make it associative and we're done. Okay. Let's see. I want to look at that curvature. Let's go through this.
So is that A prime you have there the same as you have over there? The coefficient of C, B, C, A with the matrix A, B, cross F.
A is omega A, G, A. It's a Lie algebra valued one form.
Okay.
And so I can actually write F. Remember our formula for F. Mm-hmm. We can find out how F transforms under the action of the whole group. Let's check what happens. F is an element of the Lie algebra. It's got one Lie algebra index. It's a vector. It's a vector valued two form. And we'll call that F. And what we're interested in is F prime. And what it is all of this with G's in all the right places. It's D, omega times the G is a dA, plus 1/2. All right, now look at what happens here. C, B, D, A. We've got a GA floating around somewhere. We've got an omega B plus omega C. But notice, if I have A wedge A, don't be fooled. A is a matrix. All right? A is an element of the Lie algebra. What this is A sub B, G, B wedge A sub C, G, C. So you look at that, it looks like zero, so it's probably bad notation, right? You really should write out a little more than I always write out when I do this, but A is a one form. And I can collect the one forms, I can collect these generators, and I can write the wedge product of two one forms as a half the anti-symmetric thing, AC minus AC wedge AB, GB, GC. And now I can induce that anti-symmetry over onto the G, so I can just as well write this as a half AB wedge AC with GB, GC minus GC, GA, V. CB. That's a commutator. So I can write this as half.
The second term?
Or the last term? That's a commutator of generators. So we have AB with AC. The commutator is a C, B, C, A, G, A. I just used the algebra relation, and what have I got? Voila. So, using this, I can write F, let's just write F for the moment. F is DA plus exactly A with A. Where, when I write this stuff without indices, you've got to remember there's all sorts of stuff bubbling under the surface. Gobs of stuff. Maybe as an exercise, you could write it out with all the indices. See what's really multiplying what. All right, you know, this G is a matrix. These GB, GC, that's a product of two matrices. There are some IJs and JKs multiplying on those matrices. Okay, so a very simple expression for the field strength here, or the curvature. Now we want to know what F prime is. Let's see if we can work it out. There's one dangerous sign that I want to try and get right the first time, so I'll probably pause and think about this halfway through. the thing we have to be careful of is when we take D of products. I mean, we may be okay here. Anyway, let's look at F prime. F prime is D of A prime plus A prime wedge A prime. And A prime is a whole bunch of stuff. It's all of this. GAG inverse. Which one might appropriately GAG minus BG G inverse plus GA G inverse minus BG G inverse wedge itself GA G inverse minus BG G inverse. And now we just take all of the relevant derivatives here, we get a dg a g inverse plus g dA g inverse minus, because we're passing a one form, remember a is a one form, g a dg inverse minus d squared of g is zero, and then we get plus because we're passing a one form, dg wedge dg inverse. That's all the top line. Then we start multiplying things out here. We get GA, G inverse, GA, G inverse, minus GA, G inverse, DG, G inverse, minus DG, G inverse, G, A, G inverse, plus D, G, G inverse, D, G, G inverse. Now, at some point it might become a good idea to put in indices to tell what's multiplying what here. Okay, so what is happening in the A wedge A term? Let's be a little bit careful with that. The A wedge A those are matrices that are being multiplied. Okay. Here we have AG wedge AG, but those two G's are being multiplied. So the IJ matrices here are actually being combined. So when I multiply this out, this is a matrix and that's a matrix, but I'm multiplying those, so that G inverse G really is a G inverse G, and it's a 1. So, that one's okay. Now, all this DG stuff, we may have to be a little careful. DG inverse. We'll see. If we just drop out the things that look like 1, there are some around. Let's see, now this one we'll have to rearrange a little bit. But here we get a minus DG A G inverse plus DG A G inverse. So that term actually cancels that term. DA, what about this one? It ought to look a lot like that, and it does. We need to integrate by parts. Okay, notice this G inverse multiplies that DG. And where can I go here? Okay, so notice that, like in that last term, we've got a G inverse DG. I can write that as D of G inverse G minus DG inverse G. And that first term is 0 because G inverse G is just 1. So, what I can do is where I have a G inverse DG, I can write it as minus DG inverse G. And that means that F prime is, we've got G DA G inverse. Then minus GA DG inverse. Then DG wedge DG inverse. Those are all fine the way they are. Then the next term, I'm going to interchange the G inverse DG to make it plus GA G inverse, DG inverse, right? DG inverse. G inverse. And then the very last term, I want to interchange the middle two to give minus DG, DG inverse, G, G inverse. So I've used this twice. Now, this is 1, and this is 1. So we get cancellation. Have I lost the term somewhere? There's one more term.
Six
of it. Oh, yeah, that second line. What is it? GAA G inverse. Okay. I'm getting too few things. Once that's 1, these two cancel. Once that's 1, these two cancel. So we have G dA plus A wedge A, G inverse, and F transforms as a tensor under the action of the full group. Linear homogeneous. Okay, F is a matrix, so we expect a similarity transformation. So, even if you didn't expect it, that's what we expected. So we've just proved that this F we've added is a tensor with respect to the whole group. Let's see. And we know how to write covariant derivatives. There's one more thing that might be neat to show. Maybe this would be a good exercise. It's similar to this. Let's see. You've got this. We have the Maurer-Cartan equations for the group. And we can write those as d omega a is minus a half d bca omega b wedge omega c. But we saw that we could write that as dA is equal to that was A wedge A, minus A wedge A. So in the group, the curvature is zero. So, yeah, it's sort of repeating what we just did, but show that A equals minus dg g inverse solves this. Okay, same kind of substitution. So this is called a pure gauge connection. So what we're showing here is that the Maurer-Cartan equation defines a connection, first off. And the Maurer-Cartan equation for a group defines a pure gauge connection. It's built out of local gauge transformations. These g's are functions of position on some manifold. And A gives us a connection on that manifold. It gives us a way to compare infinitesimally separated vectors anywhere on the manifold. In our case, it will be on a bundle. And we're particularly interested in those subgroup transformations. But what I was saying before is that we know how to solve the equations for Lie algebra. Well, there's the solution. Right? So dgt inverse, where g is any local specification of group elements, substitute into this and you'll find that it's satisfied. So there's your general solution for a connection in the absence of curvature. And it's that dgg inverse part that we're really not interested in. That's what moves us up and down the fiber. What we're interested in is this f, and we're interested in f because it's a tensor under the group. Right? It truly characterizes something about the manifold that it's defined on. We do a group transformation. Okay, if it wasn't zero before, it's not going to be zero after the group transformation. Right? The vanishing of a tensor is now a group invariant property. So, we've done something way beyond last semester. Right? This general relativity looks just like this, but so does every other gauge theory. So, now we need to write a standard model. We need to write general relativity. You know, we'll start looking at some particular bundles and see what they give us. We should probably, you know, develop more general properties. Let you guys work with this on. I'll have to think of what examples I can give you. This is a good one. This is straightforward, and it's just like what I did here, with half the term. So. That should be pretty straightforward to work out. But, you know, something...
You said G is in any local specification of...
of a group element. So, at each point of... these are two forms on some manifolds. Or A is a one form on some manifold. It could be the group manifold, but it could be any manifold that the group acts on, too. So if we know how the group acts on any manifold, we can write this structure as one or two form relationships on that manifold. So given G as a group element, per point of that manifold, right? It's a function of the coordinates on the manifolds at G of X. And that, so when we take DG, we're differentiating it, we're finding how it changes as you move around that manifold. But it can be any choice, right? So there are lots of different A's that we could have. There are lots of solutions to that equation. One for every choice of group element at each point of our space. Now we're only going to use a part of that symmetry. We're going to use just the fiber symmetry. And at the same time, we're using this quotient to actually build space-time. So we want our space-time, our curved space or other arena for physics, to be the manifold that we get from a group quotient. We can modify the manifold, we can connect it in different ways, but the local structure that we get from that quotient guarantees us these group properties, this group invariance, and in particular, invariance under the subgroup H. So now we've got a naturally defined set of objects, right? Because these A's are our gauge fields, and for each gauge field, we've got an F, right? There's one two-form F for every one-form A, for every dimension of the group. So we've just defined a whole lot of fields. So and here's another exercise you can try. Here's one. Two, put in the indices. In any of these calculations, I invite you to put in the indices, but let's just say in we know that F is dA plus A wedge A. A is equal to it's a one form in some space. It's an element of the Lie algebra, and so we can expand it in terms of group generators. In some linear representation of the group. So what is F A alpha beta? Equivalently, let's say F, what is it? Okay, it's some I J alpha beta. Find that thing. Okay, I and J, because A is it's an element of the Lie algebra, so it acts on some vector space. So all of this stuff acts on some vector space. Alpha beta, because it's a two form. So go ahead and put in the indices and sort that all out. And remember that the commutator, so it'll involve the structure constant. So remember that. So this last term, recall, is going to give you some structure constants. So yeah, just work that through. That'll be good practice. That'll get you a little more familiar with what's really lying under the surface here.
So A, as you said, A describes the local properties of the manifold. What F describes the general property of the manifold?
Well, F is local too. F is defined point by point. If I, J are Lorentz and alpha, beta are space-time, then all four of those indices are the same, and that's Riemann curvature tensor. Now, if it's a null field, we have an SU3 symmetry over flat space-time, then the I, J are an infinitesimal SU3 transformation. The alpha, beta are still space-time. Right. So, depending on what the group is, you might see different structures emerging from curvature, but that's the kind of thing it is. Usually it's easier to work with FA alpha beta. Yes, you might write both of those. This is that one times a G. You know, you don't need to carry the G's around all the time. You're interested in what these functions are. Those are the fields that you're trying to describe. That's particles. You know, that's the photon. That's the gluon. Whatever. Okay? Time to go.
Do you want to go climb a ridge right now and see out?
You're going to... I should check whether Meg's in the middle of an experiment. Maybe. Where are you going?
Probably 1400 or 1700 north, and just go off one of those ridges and ski down. There's some of it gets too dark.
Oh, cool.
Before the snow melts.
It'll be there. You can
smell.
Mm-hmm. A little bit. Where are the good climbing places to go to?
Oh, around here? Fucking canyons.
There's a million climbing places. Some that haven't even been developed. There are tourist attempts to be had.
Mm-hmm.
There's still glory out there.
Have you done ice climbing before?
Not really. I've been roped up and have done some things, but that's...
See,
we're going to go climb an 8,000 meter peak a few years back. I was gearing up for ice.
It's just kind of brutal.
You have to love to suffer.